We'll now hear argument in the fourth case, Michael Taylor v. State of Missouri.
May it please the Court. The prosecutor in this case told both the Court and opposing counsel he had disclosed everything about witness Pirschbacher. In fact, during the post-conviction action, the prosecutor admitted he had knowingly withheld the memo regarding witnesses or potential witnesses, Steck and Ainley. And that prosecutor's investigator testified that they had discussed this memo. Witness Pirschbacher was the crucial witness in this case. This case was a hotly contested issue about whether Mr. Taylor was not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, or whether he was a faker. He was faking mental illness. Pirschbacher came in to testify that these Cadillacs or kites came from White Bay, telling him to fake mental illness. That was Pirschbacher's role in this case.
Everybody seemed to agree, including defense counsel and the judge, that they just destroyed that guy on cross-examination and impeachment.
And I'll tell you why defense counsel is wrong, Judge. There's a difference between impeaching a witness and impeaching the witness on the correct thing. Counsel impeached him as the racist, not as the lying snitch.
Well, there were other things, too.
No, they did an abysmal job of impeaching him, Judge. And if you'd like me to go through what the state is pointing to, I'll gladly do that.
I've read the briefs.
But then in closing argument, the prosecutor still referred to this impeached witness who was totally discredited, but the prosecutor still referred to him.
In Gill's closing argument, the prosecutor argued Pirschbacher is the reason why you believe our experts on mental health. He is the reason why you believe our experts, because he is a bonus. That's the language the prosecutor used. In penalty argument, the prosecutor said he may be a racist, but he's not a liar. Believe him on penalty. This prosecutor then wrote the Jefferson County prosecutor and said in his letter that he aided and helped us successfully prosecute Mr. Taylor and urged leniency. And his letter was dictated by fundamental fairness. The prosecutor believed when he vigorously argued during the trial, when counsel opposed calling this witness on hearsay grounds, that they should be allowed to call him because he was rebuttal evidence.
Now, the PCR hearing, was there anything in the record about why the prosecutor did not turn over this memo from the investigator?
The prosecutor testified that he thought it could jeopardize a highway patrol investigation. And one of the things we've argued is that, and asked for discovery on, is whether there ever was an investigation, and if so, what was the results of that? Because the evidence clearly indicates that if there was ever an investigation, Steck and Ainley were cleared of the allegations made by Pirschbacher. Steck and Ainley could have been called to testify that these allegations of Pirschbacher are blatantly false.
Now, that would have been collateral evidence. Would they have been permitted to be called to address the credibility of a witness as opposed to the defendant or a victim?
Absolutely. Under this court's decision in Long, it made very clear that bad reputation for truthfulness of a witness is admissible through extrinsic evidence. And under Long, these witnesses could have been called to testify that Pirschbacher made false allegations against them. They would have been highly credible witnesses as police officers to establish he was the incredible witness.
Mr. Bruce says that rationale only applies where the victim is the one who is lying and not other witnesses. Is it limited in that way, or should it be?
Absolutely not. In this court's opinion, this court talked about witnesses, and then in this court's subsequent opinion in Marcellus Williams, this court talked about witnesses. It did not confine its language to purely a victim. This court spoke in language that when a witness's bad reputation for truthfulness is at issue, that witness can be attacked through extrinsic evidence. This is an easy case because Steck and Ainley were people who the prosecutor's investigator went to about this particular case. This isn't some sort of unconnected event. It's connected expressly so to this particular case. Mr. Taylor's case. They would have testified about accusations Persbacher made against them to the same prosecutor's investigator. That's what took place here. This case, getting back to the point that Judge Limbaugh was bringing up, is really like the Gary Black case in that this court found counsel was ineffective. They impeached the witnesses there, but they didn't impeach them on the right things. Right in here, counsel impeached them as the racist. And counsel's assessment is entitled to no deference as to the job they did.
When you say impeach them on the right things, you're talking about impeach them on the actual testimony, that impeachment that what he said was false, rather than on collateral matters that he's a liar or racist or something else, and that's why we shouldn't believe him.
I'm talking about the things he actually testified to, as well as his bad reputation for truthfulness. I think all of those things go to attacking his credibility.
Yes, but you're talking about, but I thought when you were talking about whether he'd been effectively impeached, the question is whether or not the actual testimony that he gave germane to this case had been impeached.
Right, and it was clearly not impeached.
Right.
It was impeached as a racist, but not the truth.
So the jury
could believe he's a racist, that he lies a lot, but that he was telling the truth in this case.
They could believe that, but they didn't hear what a liar he was.
I understand that. But if they had heard that he was a liar and that he was a racist and whatever else, you could still say, well, he's a liar and a racist, but we will still choose to believe the testimony that he gave in this case.
They could make that choice, but they were not given that choice in this case, and that's the problem. They didn't have that choice in front of them. And the jury asked for Mr. Taylor. This was hotly contested about his mental health because the jury asked for his mental health records. They were seriously considering whether he was not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect or not, and saw it as a close question because they were asking for his records and sent a note asking for those records. Getting back to the point that Judge Limbaugh was making, this is very much like the Gary Black case in that counsel impeached him on matters that were irrelevant to the issue of deliberation. They didn't impeach those witnesses on the issues that went to deliberation. Here, Persbacher was not impeached on the issues that went to deliberation as to whether or not Mr. Taylor acted with a mental disease or defect.
Let me ask you. See, when I hear you use the word impeachment, you seem to be drawing a distinction between impeaching testimony that's given and impeaching a witness. I think impeachment applies to making a witness a less credible person in the eyes of the fact finder. And that's how, when we have a statute, for example, allowing a person to be impeached with their convictions, we take that as true, that there's a reasonable presumption that a convicted person is less truthful. But we don't address impeachment to individual items of evidence, which seems to be what you're asking this court to do. In other words, I looked at the trial judge's conclusion that he was effectively impeached, meaning he was not a credible witness. But you're saying we have to look at impeachment of individual testimony? Is that how I understand your argument?
He needed to be impeached on many aspects of his particular testimony they gave. Like, he said that he had helped to find the body of a murder victim, which the head of the highway patrol could have been called to testify was absolutely false. Mm-hmm. That was untrue. That clearly and blatantly was false. So he could have been impeached on the particular item, but also could have been impeached of his testimony, but also that he generally has a bad reputation for truth and veracity.
See, what I'm wondering is this. If the trial judge is correct in concluding that he was effectively impeached, I took that to mean that the jurors wouldn't find him a credible witness, and therefore anything he gave his testimony would be ignored because they thought this man was racist, and that he was,
and lying because of that.
Poisoned by that circumstance that he couldn't be viewed as a reliable witness. In other words, wouldn't that completely eliminate the question of whether there was prejudice as to when you're talking about individually impeaching items of testimony? Because if he's not viewed as a credible witness, I assume the jurors would go back and say, well, scratch him off and we'll consider the other evidence before us.
Judge, I think your question presumes that the finding really was a finding made by the motion court, and these were findings that the attorney general drafted, which we have argued are fundamentally unfair under Smith versus Grouse because they're directly contrary to the position the Attorney General took to the jury and in the letter to the Jefferson County
prosecutor. Well, that's a different argument then.
I'm sorry, what?
You're switching arguments.
No, no, I'm not, because Judge Mooney is presuming that these findings should be given deference, and I'm saying they should be not because they're not the findings of a motion court, but the findings of the Attorney General.
Let's assume for a second they are the findings of a motion court. If they are the findings of a motion court, isn't the finding that the judge is making here that that witness was not to be believed, and that's how the fact finder would view him because he was impeached?
And I think this gets back to the Gary Black case where he was not impeached on the correct things.
Okay.
He was not impeached as the witness who cannot be believed, who is the unbelievable witness as to matters of truth and veracity. He was only impeached on one issue, that he's a racist. And being a racist doesn't translate to being something that's
unbelievable. But following up on Judge Mooney's point about the motion court, he's basically saying he's effectively impeached and therefore it would not be prejudicial to the decision of the court.
If the only effect of proving he's a racist, the only purpose was to show that he would have therefore lied because he was racist and wanted to get him. And if it had that effect, then he might have proved he lied for another reason too, but why is it prejudicial not to prove it double?
Well, it didn't have the effect of showing that he was not credible as a racist because, as the prosecutor argued pretrial, the victim was African-American here, so that doesn't matter. And the prosecutor argued in closing argument the victim was African-American, so being a racist, it doesn't even matter, and counsel knew that going in.
Could it be that the finding is just ambiguous, that it's not specific enough as to what's believed and not believed to be helpful in this situation?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Judge Price.
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, the problem is we have cases that say that regardless of who drafts the order, if a judge signs it, that's what the judge meant. And it's hard to change that because you can't go back and say, well, how much of this order was drawn by somebody else and things like that. But if it's not very clear whether he just disbelieved him because he was racist and generally disbelieved him or he specifically disbelieved him on this point, he doesn't say specifically disbelieved him on this point.
The findings generally state that he was an incredible witness. But the findings and evidence only show that he was impeached on a singular issue, that he was the racist. That was really the only thing, and that's what counsel testified to. But counsel also testified to, they would have liked to have called Steck and Ainley. They would have liked
I'm trying to help you. It's not specific enough to be bind or to be helpful to you as an appellate court, his statement there.
I don't think so. It is a generalized finding in the sense of the credibility. It doesn't address his credibility in all respects. It's a narrow finding as the issue of his racial animus. And that's what that credibility finding goes to, is racial animus. But that's not the issue here as to what was important to the jury. It's like, is he believable or not? Not that he's racist.
And that's right. And so, but impeachment is impeachment is impeachment. And if he's impeached for one person, but one reason, you know, he's impeached.
That's not what this court said in Gary Black.
Well,
that's contrary to
the court. There were other reasons too, like his criminal convictions, the very fact that he was in jail too, and
the prosecutor brought those out, and so did defense counsel. So that added nothing. That's a wash.
Not a wash. I mean, it shows that, you know, that the fact finder should be aware of something that might play on his credibility.
He also lied about the fact about that there were certain prosecutions. He said they were not pending when, in fact, they were.
What did the prosecutor say in closing argument? Did he urge the jury to believe this witness?
He urged the jury to believe their expert witnesses on the issue of mental health over the defense doctors because of Kirschbacher. He was the bonus, and that's the language he used, the bonus that the jury had for believing their experts. In penalty, the prosecutor said, it doesn't really matter if he's the racist because he's not a liar. Those were the words the prosecutor used in penalty phase. So we have that going on for the jury. They're told that he's the believable, he's the credible guy. The Attorney General has argued that he just wasn't the credible guy. Well, that's belied by the letter that was sent to the Jefferson County prosecutor that he wasn't the credible person, because the prosecutor would not have written that letter unless he was the credible witness. He would not have said he aided and helped us prosecute this case, and it was required by considerations of fundamental fairness. That's why he was writing. It wouldn't have been fundamentally fair that he had to write a letter if Kirschbacher had not been the credible witness, that if he didn't believe he was.
Let me ask you a different question, if I can. I find myself more troubled by what you claim the prosecutor did in voir dire here. As I understand it, you claim that the prosecutor, with four different panels of veneer persons, told the veneer persons that the Missouri governor had examined the Missouri criminal justice system, I gather, for difficulties as those that had been experienced recently in Illinois, and assured them that Missouri had no such problems. Could you expand on what occurred there?
Right.
I'm having difficulty. I don't have much of the record here in the brief.
I'm sorry about that. What happened there was the prosecutor was talking about what Governor Ryan had done in Illinois and his motivations for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there had been a thorough and detailed review of the Missouri statute and what has taken place in capital cases, that the jury didn't need to worry about the Illinois issue or problem, because that was not the problem in Missouri, because it had been thoroughly studied, reviewed, and determined.
Was that objected to?
No, it's alleged as IAC. And counsel should have objected to something that was clearly not accurate or truthful. And it's a further evidence of counsel's failures to produce a reliable guilt sentence and also a penalty sentence here. Both of those things. There actually, on the second alien matters, there's actually two Brady violations going on, because we have the memo not being disclosed, but the letter that's written to the Jefferson County prosecutor was written before Michael Taylor's sentencing even occurred. So we have neither being disclosed to counsel. Counsel said they would have wanted to impeach Pirschbacher with what the prosecutor in this instance did with his advocating for leniency for Pirschbacher to the Jefferson County prosecutor.
Do we need to find that the prosecutor intended at the time he said there was no deal to later on write this letter? Do we have to find some subterfuge here, or in order to find it relevant, or to find it undercuts the case that later after the trial he wrote this letter asking for leniency for his witness? Do we have to make some sort of finding that he always intended to do that?
I don't think you have to make that, and we've argued that that claim was rejected, because that's a point I briefed, and we've argued that it was established, that it was something that was understood all along. But if we didn't prove it, and it's one of our points in our brief, it was because we denied discovery on that matter, and that the case should be sent back for that discovery on that particular issue. I also want to I see that my time, it looks like, is just about to expire.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Whether or not the prosecutor intends a deal or not is not relevant. The question is whether or not the witness is testifying based on the belief that he may receive a deal. And so whether or not the prosecutor...
Well, if the prosecutor misstates to the court, and because he was asked here whether or not there was a deal, and the witness said not, and the prosecutor said not, so if the we have to separately be very concerned about that.
Sure. Well, and if the prosecutor was lying about that.
Right.
No, I mean, I agree. If there was a deal,
okay,
and it was not disclosed, then that's a problem. There's no evidence of that. And in fact, nothing that's been said subsequent to that suggests there was ever a deal. In fact, the letter expressly states he was not offered anything in exchange for his testimony.
But if the letter had been disclosed to the defendant, maybe the defendant might have pursued that and said, pursue the letter, but they had no clue if they didn't have a letter.
I'm still not sure how the defendant could have ever used that, but more important, it still doesn't change the fact that it doesn't suggest that there was a deal.
Well, let me ask you a separate question. What about reviewing the investigator's report about the accusations of the officers? Why was not that given over? What reason was given in the record for why they never handed that over to the defense?
Well, there are two reasons. One is if you read it, the memorandum, I think it's Exhibit 2, at least in the motion, it's Exhibit 2, has absolutely nothing to do with Mr. Taylor. I mean, it's totally unrelated to Mr. Taylor. The second thing is that the prosecutor said it dealt with accusations about not just two law enforcement officers, but a meth gang in Jefferson County. And so the prosecutor didn't feel like it had anything to do with it, but he was also concerned about, and he said he thought this had to do with a possible investigation of whether or not these two officers were dirty and whether or not there was a meth investigation, and he made a decision. Now, it might have been the wrong decision. And whether it was a good faith or bad faith is of no consequence. Brady is independent. A Brady violation doesn't matter whether or not the prosecutor had a good motive, and Brady also says it doesn't matter whether or not he had a bad motive. The question is, did it impact the outcome of this case? And the court clearly determined it did not.
Well, can you address this? I understand the argument is that it didn't affect it because he was effectively impeached by showing he was a racist, and that gave him motivation to lie. So if he had other motivations to lie, it wouldn't really add to it. But if the argument of the prosecutor was accepted by the jury, that the fact he was a racist did not give him reason to lie, or meant he lied here, then wouldn't it have been important for defense counsel to have alternative arguments of why they should find him to be a liar? For instance, he had made false accusations against numerous other people, and that could not be rebutted by this same argument by the prosecutor.
Well, let me just preface my answer, and I will answer. It is not true that he was only impeached on being a racist. That's just not true. He was impeached on a number of different levels, not in the way that Mr. Taylor, on hindsight, thinks that he should have been impeached, but he was impeached. But more important, in this case, trial counsel had available to them direct impeachment evidence of that issue. And I want to point out what Mr. Pirschbacher's testimony was all about. His piece of evidence really was fairly tangential anyway. In fact, I think there was some question whether or not it was even going to be admissible, because he does not accuse Mr. Taylor of saying, I'm going to fake it.
Well, why did you focus on it in closing argument, or your trial counsel focus on it in closing argument?
He's trial counsel. He thought it would be helpful. He thought maybe it would be persuasive.
But why doesn't that make, I mean, if that wasn't an issue in closing argument, wouldn't I can see your argument better, that you're saying it really doesn't make any difference, everybody knew he was lying. But when the prosecutor says, you know, the fact he was a racist doesn't mean he was lying, it has no effect on it, you should believe him anyway, then why doesn't it suddenly make all this other evidence? And I know there's an issue as to whether there was enough other evidence there that we didn't need more, but why doesn't it make the question of whether there was other impeaching evidence relating to his prior false allegations very relevant?
The fact that a prosecutor mentions the testimony of all the witnesses, whether they were good witnesses or bad witnesses, does not mean that. I mean, that's all he did. He simply acknowledged it, and he argued to the jury that this was additional, that it's not just a matter. And the vast majority of the argument dealt with the experts.
But doesn't that undercut your argument that we don't have to worry about this because it couldn't be prejudicial because he had no credibility anyway?
No, I think that anyone experienced in the court knows that a prosecutor is not going to. You can't just pretend the witness didn't testify. You have to deal with it, right? Good or bad. And I suspect that
I don't believe that's true. I mean, can't a prosecutor just cut loose a witness and say, ignore his testimony if you don't believe him? The truth is, I've proved it elsewhere and here and here and here. But that isn't what occurred here. He referred to it as a bonus. In other words, implying to my mind that there was other sufficient evidence, but this was also confirming evidence. It was of some value, a bonus value to the fact finder.
Well, he hoped it would be of some value, sure.
Right.
And that was a tactical decision that he made, just as defense counsel made tactical decisions. And the thing that I think is significant that hasn't been mentioned this morning is the fact that trial counsel had direct evidence impeaching Mr. Pirschbacher on this issue. He had White Bay. He was there. Mr. White Bay was there. And they made a decision that it wasn't necessary. They made a decision, rather than call Mr. White Bay and have him testify, no, I didn't send that kite, no, I didn't say that. They were convinced, sufficiently convinced, and made a reasonable decision that it wasn't necessary, that nobody believed Mr. Pirschbacher.
Why was it reasonable in light of the lack of other evidence, except the racism evidence?
Well, again, I'm not going to concede that that's true. I think that...
We don't know that no one believed Pirschbacher because the jury made a decision. Maybe the jury did.
Well, but I mean, that's what these hearings are all about, is making those types of decisions. And trial counsel was at least constitutionally sufficient in their duties by concluding, based on everything they had heard and everything they had seen, that it was not necessary, that he had been impeached.
And I didn't mean to imply that you were conceding something on that. What I was trying to say, I thought you were saying that Mr. White Bay was their other evidence. And I was saying, well, if that was their only other evidence and they didn't get it in, wasn't that incompetent?
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're
no.
You're saying there's additional evidence. Can you tell us what that was that impeached the
sure.
credibility on truth?
As an example, the argument that Colonel Stottlemyre should have been called. Well, you know, if Colonel Stottlemyre had been called, that would have just been a waste of time. You've got experienced trial counsel here. You've got a guy that they believe is a liar, okay? And one of the things you don't do when you have a liar on a witness stand is give them the opportunity to explain away everything. And so you go as far as you can. And just as an example, instead of saying, in this case you said this person confessed, particularly knowing that you are limited to the answers given by the witness.
But the liar on the stand is put on by the prosecutor.
I'm talking about trial strategy of them. They believe that he's a liar.
But you're giving reasons why they didn't put on some of the supplemental evidence?
No. I'm telling you that they did cross-examine him on page 1278 of the transcript, the cross-examination. These are guys you say confessed to you over the years, okay? That's a question. That's a broad question covering a number of different issues that Mr. Taylor says you should have nitpicked about at trial. Mm-hmm. And rather, instead, it's a broad sweep. So you're telling this jury that all these people confessed to you over the years. Now, that is by the question, they are suggesting to the jury, this guy's making this stuff
up. But they
up.
Didn't put in any evidence to support that he was lying about that.
Because it's collateral. Because
there any evidence showing that he had lied on prior occasions about making false accusations?
No. I mean, other than he's convicted in prison, they showed that he wanted a deal. He asked about a deal. They talked about the fact that he had conduct violations in prison. They didn't get into the specifics.
Let me ask you a different question, and that is to ask you about this voir dire. I found the state's brief particularly unconvincing on this point. The movement's attorney claims that with four separate panels, because of the currency of the Illinois moratorium and report that had occurred about the criminal justice system there and exonerations that I think had occurred in the Illinois system, prosecutor assured the panel that Missouri didn't have such problems and that they'd been studied. Can you tell me what occurred here?
Sure. It wasn't exonerations. What had happened was this was during the period of time, and mm-hmm. the court's well aware, where that was a big issue, where Governor Ryan in Illinois had issued a moratorium.
Mm-hmm.
That's what had occurred, is he had declared a moratorium. And then I think subsequent to that is when Governor Ryan had this panel or this commission do this study.
But why was it proper to talk about in voir dire?
Well, I think it was very proper because jurors must believe that the laws that they are given, the instructions they are given under law, are accurate and true. They can't second-guess the law.
Let me make a distinction. I found convincing part of your argument, and that is that they could voir dire the panel as to whether they'd heard about the Illinois study and moratorium and it would have an effect on their deliberation. But let me tell you what troubles me, and this is referred to in the movement's brief on page 162. It says, Ozens assured the veneer persons on all four panels they could vote for the death with confidence because Missouri system was not plagued with the problems that caused Illinois' Governors Ryan to commute all Illinois death sentences. As proof, Ozens represented Missouri governors had reviewed Missouri's practices and found no problems. Now, I don't find this to be a reference to whether you believe laws are constitutional or not. It seems to me it's a encouragement to the jury that Missouri's criminal justice system does not operate with the same flaws.
Right.
Now, how is it that you can encourage a jury on something? There's no record that I'm aware of something like this occurring. Can you explain how this is proper voir dire?
Well, let me first say,
you claim it is proper voir dire, not merely that it's not ineffective assistance of counsel, but you claimed in your brief that this was proper.
And let me first say, not everything that was said in there is what Mr. Austin says. Much of it is. He did say that the state is not plagued with the same problems in Illinois.
How can he do that?
Well, I think you have to have the jury, particularly when it is. This is not a situation where anybody could ignore. You're in a courtroom in St. Charles where it is reasonable to assume that a majority, at least, of the jurors have heard about these problems in Illinois. And you've heard not just from reliable sources, but you've heard from unreliable sources.
But is it proper to introduce factual information in the voir dire to refute that, to say, well, we don't have the same problems in Missouri and because the governor's already looked at it and we're good over here?
Well, no, I would have handled it differently.
Going over the line where the proper question would be, can you put aside what you've heard about Illinois and judge the case as you determine it by the facts that are given to you in this courtroom?
Well, I mean, I think you have to go a little farther than that. If you're concerned, and I think there's a legitimate reason to be concerned, that
well,
someone will say...
put in evidence that the governor of Missouri has done a review?
No, because it doesn't have anything to do with the case. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with the guilt or innocence of Mr. Taylor. Now, but the questioning... But during voir dire...
But the question is, are you going to be influenced by what you've heard in the media about what's going on in Illinois? Right.
And are you going to be somehow concerned? And it would be an improper concern for a juror.
It would be improper in Missouri. Let me ask you, when did Missouri institute post-conviction DNA testing? Was that at this time? Do you think that bespeaks a problem that perhaps we do concern ourselves with the possibility of exonerations?
I think it was subsequent to this. I'm not sure of that, but I think it was subsequent to this that we enacted our statute.
I'm unfamiliar with it. What is the nature of the study the governor conducted, and what did he conclude?
I believe there was an announcement that to that effect. I mean, I don't think that
was
that
there a study or just
no. I think that there had been some kind of review, and I'm. In the time frame, I'm not sure of, but I don't think that it was not the same thing that was done here. What the state has a legitimate concern about, and it was addressed, and I think it was addressed in an effective way, maybe not the best way, but in an effective way, was jurors, when you go back and make your decision about whether or not Mr. Taylor is or is not guilty of the crime, and when you make a decision about whether or not he does or does not deserve the death sentence, you should not factor in making your own decisions about whether or not Missouri's laws are constitutional or not. I mean, that's not
but,
their
but,
role.
But it went beyond that, and the question, I can't think of the case, but there was a case some time ago where it was held improper basically to assure the jury not to worry because the judge will look at their verdict, and they don't really bear the ultimate responsibility. It's the judge. Isn't this, in a way, doing that same thing? Say, don't worry, we've looked at it, and nobody gets wrongly convicted here, so it's all taken care of. You don't have to worry that somebody's going to get wrongly convicted. Why doesn't that second part, not the first part, which I agree it was okay, but the second part have that same kind of effect?
No, I don't think that's because those arguments that were improper, what was happening was the jurors were being told it's not really your final decision. Someone else will make the final decision, and kind of reducing their responsibility. That's not here. Here, all the prosecutor was trying to communicate was you are not to be concerned about whether or not Missouri's laws are or are not constitutional.
No, it's not a question of constitution. It's whether or not there's a possibility of error, to my mind, not whether they're constitutional or not. We don't ask the jurors to decide that question. Let me also mention how the motion court addressed this issue. The trial counsel acknowledged it in the motion court that Ozen's statements went further than the law allowed, but despite that did not object. The motion court rejected the claim because there had not been a showing Missouri had Illinois' problems, and therefore Ozen's statements were proper. Was it up to the movement to show that Missouri had Illinois' problems? I mean, here it is, the prosecutor that seems to be vouching for the Missouri system, but in the motion court's placing the burden on movement to show the existence of problems. It strikes me that such voir dire is just improper because you're really going outside anything that's properly before a fact finder.
Well, I think the motion court was doing exactly what it was supposed to do. I mean, the issue the motion court has to decide was Mr. Taylor prejudiced by anything the prosecutor did? And the movement does have the responsibility to establish the prejudice. And I still believe that
manifest injustice.
Correct.
Because it's plain error. They didn't object to this.
Correct. And all the prosecutor has done here, now again, clearly some feel that he should have expressed it in a different way, but all he was getting...
No, I think he shouldn't have done it. Yeah.
Well, and I would disagree. I think given the publicity...
I think he can voir dire about Illinois and say, can you set that aside and decide this case on the record before you? Fine. But then in assuring them that the Missouri system has been studied and found not wanting, with four separate panels, with no objection from defense counsel, even though defense counsel believed it to be beyond the reach of the law?
Well, but there's no prejudice to Mr. Taylor because all that they're being asked to do is simply to assume that Missouri law is constitutional. And that's what we want the jurors to believe. I don't think he asked the jurors to do anything other than what we asked them to do when we give instructions, when the jury's instructed to follow the law.
Was the problem in Illinois that there were that the laws were unconstitutional, or whether, or was it rather that we, that there were cases where there were exonerations of people that had been wrongfully convicted, which was the case in Illinois?
There were a broad number of issues, and one of the allegations was, and I, again, it, depending on kind of which period of time, but I remember some of the op-ed pieces from St. Louis Post-Dispatch talked about how people in, you know, there were Chicago police officers that were beating confessions, and people were, I mean, there was a pretty serious concern.
Of prosecutorial, you know, misconduct also.
Well, there was that aspect too, but I think it was really more directed towards law enforcement, at least my recollection of the accusations. And that it's only through DNA testing were these people being exonerated. Jurors have to have some faith in the system that it's working, and they, because they are part of the system.
But we don't want them, for example, assuring. I mean, for example, I think courts have held it improper for a prosecutor to assure that he only brings charges that he believes in and vouches, and that sort of seems to be in this. In other words, the message here seems to be, we know Missouri's system is working. And that could be taken rather broadly, not just to include the courts, but police agencies, prosecutorial agencies, and the rest. And that seems a pretty broad guarantee to give out in voir dire.
But I think it's a... I understand it is possible to come to that conclusion, but I think it, I don't think you can assume that that's what the prosecutor was intending, or that the jurors necessarily assumed that. I think that all he was doing was saying, you can assume that our system works. That is what they are supposed to assume. That's what they have to assume. And that's what he was asking. And I don't see how Mr. Taylor could be prejudiced, because I can see the jurors coming to no conclusion other than him. And maybe assuring is the word, and maybe he shouldn't have assured them, but assuring them that the system is a fair system. Well, that's exactly what jurors have to believe. And therefore, I don't see how he could have been prejudiced by it. And I do want to point out before my time is up that the court, I think, very clearly found that Mr. Pershbacher was, in the words of his trial attorney, thoroughly impeached. The court also heard Mr. Pershbacher's testimony and concurs that he was not credible or believable, and that his testimony had no impact on the outcome of this case and the verdict of the jury. The court listened to it. Defense counsel listened to it. They had lots of other evidence. They decided Mr. Pershbacher was not necessary. And the last thing you want to do when you have successfully impeached somebody is to make that discredited witness into a sympathetic witness. And by pounding away at him, that's the only thing that could have possibly happened. And a smart attorney and a good attorney and competent attorney, which is what Mr. Taylor had, knew to leave well enough alone and sat down.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to directly address what Mr. Bruce just said about Exhibit 2. Mr. Bruce said that there was no reason to turn this over. Well, in Exhibit 2, Mr. Dressenhaus's memo, he expressly reports that he told Pershbacher that he might be testifying against Michael Taylor. So there clearly was, in the text and body, he told Pershbacher he could be a witness against Michael Taylor. This had to be turned over, because it was specifically related to Michael Taylor's case. There's no way, two ways about it. As far as White Bay and the counsel's failure to cross, failure to call him, counsel's reasons for failing to call him is that they were concerned that White Bay would say that Michael Taylor had said that his father had doctors caused him to commit the prior case, which wasn't the defense that was presented. The defense that was presented in that prior case is really irrelevant. It's not a reasonable strategic decision. It may be a strategic decision, but it's not a reasonable one. That was not a good strategic decision or a reasonable one to fail to call White Bay. One of the items that Mr. Bruce pointed to was that Pershbacher was cross about the fact that he said that he had helped to solve all the murders. The cross starts out saying, and I've referenced it in my briefs, it goes like this. You claim to have solved several murders. And Pershbacher responds, I don't claim. I have solved them. So that's not impeachment. He's asserting the truthfulness of his assertions.
Don't you think that they're making a caricature of him when he makes wild assertions like that?
No, not at all.
That was the whole purpose of the question.
Not at all, Judge. That is, in fact, not the case at all. They're not making him out to be the guy who makes lots of accusations.
He's a
He is. He's exactly that. He is the bonus. That's what was argued in closing argument. He's the bonus to believe.
I thought these were questions that were made by the defense counsel on impeachment.
Which questions are you referring to?
That last question that you just said about haven't you claimed other people committed, he's helped solve other murders, and he said yes. What was the purpose of asking that was
right, that's cross-examination. And he says, I don't claim, I in fact did it. Yeah. And he goes on to say, I helped find the body in this Takio case. So he vouches for the legitimacy. That may be what counsel had hoped for, is what you're saying, but they didn't get it. The jury heard otherwise.
You're
they heard
after
the
that,
trial judge thought that they... That was the impression that the witness gave.
I take issue with that because of how the findings were prepared by the AG's office and signed by the trial judge. I can't endorse that, Judge.
What other evidence? I'm unclear what other evidence there was attacking the veracity of the witness, not the racism issue, but we have the white bay, which was chosen not to put on. We have this impeaching question, and there's a question that we've been discussing about how effective it was. What other evidence was there that went to his credibility?
Well, counsel tried to establish that he had psych treatment, and he denies that he had psych treatment.
Psych treatment, okay.
Right. And he was, in fact, as the PCR showed, he was actually an escapee from a psych ward. So he denied what counsel wanted to establish.
And did counsel not have anything?
They didn't have that to rebut it. They tried to get his psych records. The state opposed it, and the trial judge refused to turn over his psych records. They wouldn't order those disclosed to counsel. They wanted to impeach him on that he was the crazy guy, and they were not allowed to do that. They tried to attack Pershbacher on his conduct violations, and when they questioned him about that, it only showed that he had many bad behaviors. And he denied certain violations that his corrections record showed he had. So they didn't. He was disputing what his corrections record showed he actually had as conduct violations and denying them. So counsel ended up looking like a fool. It looked like they didn't know what they were talking about, asking about conduct violations that he was denying.
And so if he had specifics, the impeachment would be much more specific and more in your argument more convincing.
Absolutely,
and more,
Judge.
And more persuasive to
absolutely. And that's what our second point goes to about these allegations of giving false information. He is a guy who has a history of giving false information. This is someone who has repeatedly given false information at the penitentiary, yet counsel had those records showing that, but didn't use those to impeach that he had many violations for giving false information. I don't think that anything, you know, other than the Steck and Ainley information shows that he's the incredible guy, is the fact that he gives false information, and those are the violations that he's getting. That was compelling evidence. And those were in his corrections records, and those were not used to impeach him.
So that goes to counsel being ineffective and not impeaching as opposed to not getting discovery. That's
an issue of counsel failing to use the corrections records that were available to them, that they could have used these things to show that he was the guy who gives false information all the time. The state says that in response, I think it was Judge Tuttle who asked about this, to the prosecutor's letter to the Jefferson County Prosecutor's Office, it wouldn't have really mattered. Well, that letter was written pre-sentencing. Counsel could have used that at the new trial motion hearing to argue about, to make arguments regarding Pershbacher in terms of why a new trial should have been granted. That should have been disclosed, but it was never disclosed. It wasn't uncovered until the PCR itself. I see I'm out of time, and I ask this court reverse both the conviction and a penalty phase in ordering a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you.